So, Alan.
Yeah.
I think we need to do a little bit of follow-up.
Oh, no.
And address the elephant in the room.
I don't know what you're talking about. That's the road I'm going to take.
Okay, well, I'll try to refresh your memory. A few episodes ago, I think it was our first episode, actually, we talked a lot about kitchen injuries and technique to avoid injuring yourself. And then you told me this week that you had a pretty bad injury at work. Is that right?
It did. Like, it crossed my mind that you would bring that up. But if you had asked me, like, in my heart's mind, I didn't think you were actually going to bring it up, but you did. So,
welcome to Food Court. My name is Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Sutterby.
Hello.
We love food, and we love to talk about it.
Yeah, I got one of... Again, I'm not a doctor, but like I got what I think might be the worst cut of my career this week.
Harsh.
And by God, I mean gave myself. I've never, like, we talked about the, actually we talked at great length, the like taking the end off your finger cut. And
mm-hmm, yeah.
And I know we also talked about like hating the people who brag about never cutting themselves.
Right.
But honestly, I don't think I've ever actually, I've cut myself many times and severely, but I've never taken the end off a finger before until last week.
Yeah.
And I took the end off my thumb, and I think, sorry, with a kitchen knife, if that's not clear from what, from the context,
right.
Like using a kitchen knife, I took the end off my left thumb. And I think that the way that I reacted to it was different because of the conversation that we had.
Oh, really?
By which I mean, not the immediate reaction. Like, the immediate reaction was to stop the bleeding and to apply gauze and stuff. But because our conversation was, how do injuries like that reform your technique so that they never happen again? And so when I'm trying, I tried to figure out why that happened, because I've never done that exact. I've never done that before. And so I realized that there's like my thumb is usually tucked behind my curled fingers.
Right.
Quite comfortably. But that when I'm repositioning the ingredient that I'm cutting, sometimes that thumb darts out in front of the fingers.
Gotcha.
And I was doing this kind of rapidly and manically on the line. And my thumb darted out to reposition something, and I sliced it. I sliced it off, and so it's something that needs to be addressed about my technique, like, because it's something that, like, I think that it is a habit, but that when I'm working at a reasonable pace or whatever, like, it's not usually an issue. But if it's like once in 5 or 10 years that I cut the end of my thumb off, I should probably reevaluate my technique and focus on. Making sure that thumb never leaves
the safety of the little pocket behind your fingers that are curled over.
Yeah. The protection of the curled fingers. Yeah. I don't know if that's how I would have interpreted it or thought about it if we hadn't had that conversation, but that's how I'm thinking about it now.
And do you feel like you sort of have settled on any kind of solution for how to change your technique to avoid that? Like, I think, like, as you're describing it to me, it sounds like, maybe the reason why you haven't done that before is that when you're working at a reasonable pace, when your thumb darts out to help reposition the food that you're cutting, your cutting hand stops doing the cutting that it's doing for that moment until your thumb is like back behind your fingers where it's safe.
Mm-hmm.
But that maybe if you were rushing, you were just like in a rhythm with your cutting hand and you just did this motion that is sort of like a normal part of what you do when you're cutting, and you, but your other hand didn't stop cutting and your thumb happened to be in the way. Is that sort of what happened?
Or? Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe what needs to happen is you just need to slow down. Maybe that's the only way to address it.
Yeah. I mean, that could be, but it'd probably be better if I could work at a faster pace and just keep my thumb tucked away.
Right.
Right. Or no, I don't know.
It's, no, yeah, I think you're right. But like, it,
you don't want to work at a frantic pace, but like,
right. Yeah. Yeah. That's what I mean. Like it's maybe not the speed. Like I've seen you cut things. You can cut things quickly, but still do it in a controlled way. But yeah. Maybe, you know, maybe it was like the situation or the franticness that
yeah
contributed to that.
There's always like after some kind of, after an injury like that, like you always, when you go back to handling that equipment and being in a similar situation, I think there's always like you have a little bit more respect and you're thinking a little bit harder about what you're doing. And hopefully that just starts to build better habits.
Yeah. Because there's a certain period of time where you're really conscious of how you're doing, of how you're cutting after you do something like that.
Yeah.
And then
yeah,
that probably is the time when you have the opportunity to try and help form a new habit.
Yeah.
Or like a more safe habit.
I know like you're a very like practical and pragmatic guy, as am I, but like when, this idea of like respecting the equipment, which sounds kind of like, I don't know what, like new age stuff, but like I haven't cut myself on I haven't cut myself on a, on a mandolin in
right
probably something like 8 years, whatever, 5, 6, 8 years. And yeah. I feel like it's because every time I pick up a mandolin, I think of the last horrible cut that I got on it.
Right.
Like I just remember it so vividly that like it's like this kind of little prayer that I say to the mandolin that's like, I'm going to respect you and you. Do you know what I mean? Like it just
I do the same thing, but I have been in a situation where I've been like frantically trying to prep something and using a mandolin to do it.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. Even though I, you know, in that situation, I still, you know, was like afraid of the mandolin, yes, like, and trying to give it the respect that it deserves, it's still,
but also, you know, do the job.
I've definitely moved faster than I should have been using a mandolin, you know, yeah, like, but yeah. Anyways,
enough.
I hope that it's healing up nicely.
Yeah, it's good.
Oh, good. Yeah. You have in our video chat, I can see that you have a blue Band-Aid on, which is nice.
Honestly, we could talk about it for another 20 minutes, but we probably don't need to. So let's just
move on. No, you're right. So we have it's sort of a one topic show, I think, and it's kind of your topic idea.
Yeah, it has a it's actually quite a simple concept, but it has a complicated, like conversational history with us, I think.
Right.
The simple concept is just that one of us presents a dish or an idea for a dish or a concept or a set of ingredients, something fairly open-ended, and the other describes how they would, in a very practical sense, put that dish together.
Right.
Are we on the same page?
Yeah, I think so. And then I think additionally, or on top of that, there's like probably a phase two where we go back to the original idea presenter and see how it matches up to what they had in their head.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
So it's pretty straightforward. It came out of like, we've had numerous conversations now about how difficult it is in cooking, but probably in any field, to do something that's even marginally creative, like something that you haven't seen exactly done that way before. All of these kind of variables that you didn't foresee come into play, and it ends up getting more difficult or complicated, and you end up having to do more iterations than you thought to be successful. That's my recollection of the conversations, like that for like for cooks, it's like you see something that works and you just grasp it and you put it in your pocket and you carry it with you. And as long as everything unfolds exactly as it did when you first saw it or made it, it's great. But then like, if you try and push the boundaries a little bit, like you just enter this other world where sometimes you feel like you are not a good cook. Those were the kinds of like feelings. And
well, what do you mean by push the boundaries? Like,
oh, and I don't even mean in like a really like a glamorous, like, I just mean like do it in a way that wasn't exactly as it was done before, or in a way that you can just Google, like just something that you haven't seen before. And it doesn't need to be, yeah, like I said, like you're not like discovering relativity. You're just like changing an ingredient, or you're changing something about the technique. And then,
right. Because maybe you don't have a certain piece of equipment, or maybe you're serving it in a different context or than you originally saw it served in, or something like that.
Like, okay. So it's probably, we'll just use a concrete example. So like one of the things that I'm often working with, like, or working to do casually at home, is like use local ingredients that are not commonly represented in the literature at culinary schools. So for instance, like sour cherries in Edmonton, or in the prairies, the prairie provinces, there's like a dozen or so varieties of sour cherries that are really delicious and grow prolifically, but they have almost nothing or very little in common with like the sweet, say like Bing cherries that we get in grocery stores from British Columbia. They're like, have a much softer texture and different colors, and like they're extremely, they're very tart. And so like, how do you cook with those? And say 10 years ago, when I was first wondering about that, I was looking at lemons. I was like, well, okay, well, like lemons are really sour, just like our sour cherries. So like, what do you do with lemons? You make lemonade and you make like lemon tart, like the like classic like French bistro lemon tart.
Yeah, like a lemon curd.
Yeah. Thing. So like lemon juice and egg yolks and sugar in like a short pastry. And so that was one of the first things I tried to do with sour cherries, and it didn't work. So like for a number of reasons, it didn't work. The amount of egg yolk, and the cool thing about French lemon tart is that the custard looks just like a bright yellow lemon zest. Like it's just like the happiest, sunniest color that you can imagine.
Yeah.
But when you substitute the juice of sour cherries for lemon juice in that recipe, it just kills the color because of all the butter and egg yolk. Like it mutes it and turns it into like this sad kind of like pink mauve,
right,
drab color. And so that's
which
like
is not a nice color to eat.
It's a non-starter. Like it's like, well, that doesn't work. It also, like, the acidity of the sour cherries just doesn't behave. It's not the same as the acidity of lemons. And so that fat, I think the yolks and the butter just like kill the acidity of the sour cherries, which is kind of what you want. Like you need to balance it with sweetness, but like it needs to be tart. Like it needs to be sour. That's the character of the fruit.
Yeah. Like the thing with the lemon tart is that the sourness of the lemons is so potent that it cuts right through all that fat and sugar. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
But the cherries are probably not quite as sour as lemons, and so it's harder to find that balance, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so when you eat the cherries out of hand, you're like, holy Christ, these are sour. They really need fat and sugar. But so it's hard to tell out of hand that they're much less sour than lemons, because they're almost unpalatably sour on their own. But yeah, they don't stand up to the same techniques as lemon. And so you do more iterations and you figure out what works. So that's an example of what I mean. Like, it seems like a simple one-to-one substitution, but it's not. And then it opens up this whole world of, like, okay, well, if it's, do we just dial down the fat? Do we, instead of thickening it with egg yolks and butter, are we using gelatin or pectin? And then that's like a whole, especially for someone who's not a pastry chef like me, it's just like, well, I don't know where I am anymore. Like, I don't know. Anyway, so that's an example.
What am I even making?
Yeah, exactly.
I had kind of like an interesting thought about lemon tart, which is obviously a tangent, but I just thought I would throw it in for fun. I think it's kind of ironic that, like, because you're right, lemon tarts look like this beautiful, bright, vibrant, like yellow lemon color. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, it's kind of funny that, like, most of that color actually comes from the egg yolks,
yes,
not from the lemons.
Yeah.
which is funny, because then, like, yeah, when you try to, like, it just so happens that the lemon juice is also, like, kind of a pale yellow, so they sort of, like, complement each other and you get this, like, rich yellow color.
Yeah.
But then when you try to use a food that's a different color with the egg yolks,
it looks like, so
destroy,
like,
destroy each other's beauty.
So if you tried to make a lime tart with a lemon tart recipe, it won't look like limes. It will look like sad lemons. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, like, yeah. Because of the egg.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, like, that's why, like, key lime pie always has green food coloring in it, because it just, yeah. But that's what makes that, like tarte au citron so beautiful, right? Is that it's like the necessary ingredients structurally reinforce our idea of what color a lemon is. Like, it's just like, it's perfect.
Okay, next episode we'll do food history of the lemon tart.
Do you know that? Is that, or we have to do research? I don't want to do research.
No, but now I'm super curious about it.
Yeah.
I want to go Googling right now. I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head, like, the food history of lemon curd or lemon tart.
Mm-hmm. Me neither.
I would kind of be surprised to find out that the documented history of it isn't French, but yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I have no idea. I only associate it with, like, French bistro.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have no idea. Okay. So.
Okay, Alan, I'm ready.
I'm just going to present to you basically the name of a dish. And I don't know, maybe you've made, it's not a real thing, but it's something that we make at home. Sorry, not you and I, but me, like, I make for my family at home.
Yeah, I understand.
And so I'm just going to say the name of it. And I'm just going to leave the rest up to you, and you're going to tell me how you would prepare it.
I got my recipes to present to you from the internet instead of from my own repertoire.
Okay. But, yeah. Well, I'm only choosing this because I wanted to start with something that I had actually already, well, me and Lisa had already, like, thought through and actually made our own decisions about it, instead of it just being like an abstract idea from the internet. But the dish is...
that makes way more sense than my idea.
Okay. Well, yours will be fun too. So the dish is beet fried rice. Beet fried rice.
Beet fried rice. Okay.
That's it.
Beet fried rice.
So it's not... I don't think that's a traditional type of fried rice, but we know what fried rice is and we know what beets are. So
gotcha.
If you were to make beet fried rice, I guess it's probably worth explaining, like, what your goals would be, like what your desired outcome would be,
yeah,
and then how you would achieve it, if that makes sense.
Sure, sounds good. Okay, beet fried rice. Well, right off the bat, I sort of feel like I have an ace in the hole, because I've been making fried rice like 2 times a week for the last like 4 or 5 months.
Really?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, I kind of got, I don't know what happened. I think when I was researching Ramadan, I found a YouTube channel of, I can't remember what it's called. I wish I could remember what it's called, but it's this Korean guy, and he, he makes dishes at home and then presents them to his wife, I assume, who then tries them and tells him how delicious they are. Okay. But his recipes are really great, and they're like sort of, some of it I think is like a little bit Asian fusion, but a lot of it is like pretty deeply Korean. And when I was looking up information about Ramdon, I was also like looking into other Korean food stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, what was it? Oh yeah. I was looking for like a good technique to make Korean fried chicken.
Right.
And then this guy has a video where he makes fried chicken in Korean style. And so I used his video to make fried chicken at home, which was really good.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just watched a bunch more of his videos, and a couple of them were, I think one of his videos has like five rice dishes or something.
Okay.
And one of them is a fried rice dish. Also, Alan, I don't know if you know who Uncle Roger is. Do you know who Uncle Roger is?
I don't think so, no.
Okay. Uncle Roger is a YouTube comedian. And he has this like famous, or he has this viral video where he makes fun of this British television chef, this woman who makes fried rice in her kitchen and does it in like a very, non-Asian,
yes,
or using very non-Asian techniques.
Yeah.
And he's just reacting to it, and his reactions are funny.
It's impossible for us to stay on topic, but
I know. I'm getting back to it, but
okay.
But you asked about why I've been making fried rice.
Yes.
And yeah. Basically the answer, the long story short answer is I got interested in Korean food, and I was also obsessed with fried rice because of Uncle Roger.
Oh, okay. Okay. You can just cut it out if it's getting too long and
rambling. Yeah, don't worry about it.
So white people instructing how to make fried rice. I have a great, I can't believe that you mentioned that. So when at NAIT, at the Northern Alberta Institute of Technology, where I teach, there's an instructor who's been there for 30 years, and his name is Chef Ron Wong.
Okay.
And he grew up in Edmonton. His parents were from Canton, and as he grew up in his family's restaurant that served Chinese and Western food. And he told me the story, and I won't relate the whole thing with all the details, but when he started instructing at NAIT, there was a very senior instructor of European ancestry who, for whatever reason, decided he needed to teach Ron Wong how to make fried rice. And Ron has made, he literally grew up in a Chinese Canadian restaurant, but he stood there and listened to everything the man had to say while there were literally instructors behind their backs, like laughing their asses off because of how absurd the situation was of this ancient white man trying to teach Ron how to make fried rice. But the way that Ron tells the story is like, you can learn something from everyone. And he acknowledged that probably he wasn't going to learn anything right now but he had the respect and realized that maybe he could learn something. I mean, he didn't about fried rice, but it's a story about attitude, about like
shocking.
It's a story about racism perhaps and condescension, but it's a story like that's Ron's attitude, is that like, I could learn something, and so I'm going to listen and be respectful. But anyways, we are talking about, what we're actually talking about is beet fried rice.
Beet fried rice.
A made-up dish that's soon to be the provincial dish of Alberta. Not actually, that was just a joke.
How would I make beet fried rice?
Yeah.
How would I go about making beet fried rice? Okay, well, so right off the top of my head, to me, fried rice is a leftovers dish.
Yes.
So I'm thinking the reason why I'm making beet fried rice is because I have rice in the fridge from a previous meal.
Mm.
And I have beets in the fridge from a previous meal.
Okay.
So rice and beets. I'm going to basically employ my regular fried rice method.
Mm-hmm.
And use beets as a garnish, like an internal garnish for the fried rice dish.
Mm-hmm.
to me, fried rice isn't fried rice without eggs. So
yep.
Beet fried rice is going to have eggs in it as well.
Yep.
And how I used to do that is I would fry the eggs. I would scramble the eggs and fry them in the pan or in the wok.
You have a wok?
I don't know if I should admit this, but I don't actually have a wok.
Yeah. That's okay.
I've been using a cast iron pan,
mm-hmm.
which, yeah, I don't know. It does not work as well as a wok.
Right.
But storing a wok to me is like, seems like it's going to take up a lot of my cupboard space.
Mm-hmm.
I get so previously I would get some oil hot in the pan and I would use like a pretty neutral oil, and then I would add just like a touch of sesame oil. And I would scramble my eggs and then put them, once the pan's hot, put them in the pan with the hot oil and cook the eggs, season them with salt and probably pepper. I used to put a little bit of soy sauce in my eggs before I would fry them,
mm-hmm.
but I kind of stopped doing that because I like the color of the eggs.
Right, yeah.
So I would just... season them with salt. But what I have been doing, and what I learned from watching this Korean guy's YouTube channel, is he like breaks up the rice so that it's like ready to go, and then he like takes however many eggs he needs basically to completely cover the rice in scrambled eggs.
Okay.
Scrambles them and then just pours the eggs into the same bowl with the rice and mixes it all together. So you've got like this rice and egg slurry.
Yeah.
Basically enough egg that there's no like rice piled up out of the top of where the egg like.
But this is like he's mixing whisked eggs in with the cold rice before it goes into the pan. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. That's what I would do. I've got my rice and eggs and they're all mixed together. Mm. The eggs are scrambled and it's seasoned with salt, pepper, and a little bit of MSG, which I've always been using.
Mm.
Then I would put, neutral oil in my pan, a little bit of sesame oil, and then, take the thinly slice the white part of some green onions, toss those in the oil.
And throw the green parts in the garbage.
Yeah, just chuck the green parts out.
I think that was something we talked about. Sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead.
Yeah. I would cut up the white parts and put them in the oil immediately. The green parts I would reserve for garnish at the last step. I should probably back up. I have... the beets, which were previously roasted.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going to cut them up into small pieces, like a little bit bigger than a grain of rice, but like twice or three times the size of a grain of rice,
mm-hmm.
Like little dice probably of okay. beets. So I'm going to put the green onion whites in the oil, cook until they haven't really started to color, but they're just on the verge of being about to color.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm going to put the beets in the pan with the oil, and same situation, like cook them until, you know, they're verging on starting to take on some color.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm going to pour the whole rice and eggs situation into the pan.
Right.
Use my spatula to keep stirring it until... basically, the rice and the eggs are no longer a liquid, but they start to become like a fluffy sort of similar texture to like couscous or something okay. like that.
Yeah.
Like not dry, but like fluffy enough that the grains of rice aren't sticking together.
Yes.
And all of the grains of rice are coated with egg
mm-hmm.
and they're not all sticking to each other in a big clump.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm going to reduce the heat and just keep cooking it a little longer. Take the green parts of my green onions, put those in, and then I'm going to pull the whole thing off, put it into a serving bowl. I usually reserve like a small amount of green onions that I don't actually, of the onion greens that I don't actually put in while it's like cooking, just to throw on top to pretty it up a little bit.
Yep, yep.
And then I usually garnish it with a little bit of sesame seeds.
Okay.
And then I usually eat it with a fork. How close am I, Alan?
Oh, pretty close. Like it's, so when I hear that, so you're right that like stir-fried rice should be made from leftovers. Most crucially, the rice itself. Like it needs to be rice that is kind of dry and not sticky and stodgy. Probably I actually don't know what's traditional, but like for me, that means like it's probably a long grain rice. Like it's not like Calrose or something sticky like that. And ideally it was cooked the day before or well ahead and chilled in a fridge to kind of dry out. Mm-hmm. For us, the beet component is usually from fresh raw beets. And
what I
wonder, like if you use beets that were previously roasted or boiled, if you'll lose the, because when we make it, the rice becomes stained with the pigment of the beet. And so like the rice takes on this deep pink color and it's studded with the deep purple of the beets themselves.
Right.
So I would wonder, and I don't actually know if this is the case, if you used beets that were previously cooked, especially if they're boiled, although you mentioned roasted beets, I wonder if they wouldn't offer up as much of their color to the rice itself and you'd end up with like...
Yeah, I think you're right. Like they would still probably stain the rice.
But not as dramatically.
A bit, but maybe not as much as using raw beets. Yeah.
So what we do, well, first we start with bacon. So like we'll cook like very slender lardons or small dice bacon to get the fat.
Oh my God, I'm an idiot.
And some fried rice uses bacon, but some, or I don't know. I won't pretend to be to know much about fried rice, but we'll cook bacon and get the fat, and then we'll add minced onion, garlic, ginger, and small diced beets. Like, not more than a quarter inch diced beets. And they're raw. So they take as long to soften up as the onions do to like become translucent and flavor the oil and all that, at least.
Right. And the ginger.
Yeah. And then, you could proceed as a regular fried rice at that point and like add your cold rice, like your cold day old rice, and add pre-scrambled eggs or whatever the method is. If it's the summertime, well, like the kind of like chopped greens component that is sometimes added to it, we'll add beet greens. But one funny thing is like the eggs, if you do, I actually don't know what's the more common, but I some point over the last couple years like changed from adding raw egg into the pan with the rice to like pre-scrambling the egg, just because sometimes I found that when I added the like raw egg to the fried rice in the pan, it like kind of just like made it kind of glommy, like it just kind of like stuck everything together and you lost that like like the rice being separate and dry and falling over itself. And so I started
absolutely. You just got to push through that barrier, Alan,
until it cooks hard enough that it all just separates kind of.
There's a wall. Okay. Like at first you're like, oh my God, I ruined my rice.
Yeah.
My rice is garbage. I'm going to have to throw this whole thing in the garbage. And then you're cooking and you're like, wait a minute, this is turning into beautiful fried rice.
Cool.
And all of the grains are totally coated with egg.
Yeah.
And then,
Okay. So the like pre-scrambling the eggs, and not scrambling like making North American breakfast, but like scrambling like hot oil, streaming the eggs while whisking with a chopstick. So it's like a very fine grain scramble.
Yeah.
And that was a technique that I'm pretty sure I saw. There's a YouTube channel called Chinese Cooking Demystified that I ripped it from.
Okay.
So doing that technique, pre-scrambling the eggs for inclusion in fried rice. When you add the eggs to the beet fried rice, you have pink rice and purple beets, and then like quite bright yellow egg yolk pieces, or sorry, not egg yolk, quite bright yellow egg pieces distributed through. And to me, the color palette was like not very attractive at all.
Okay.
And so we just decided I just serve it with a poached egg on top now. So you get the, I know it's not,
oh.
it's, you get the egg component, but not the weird color palette of pink and yellow and purple. And so,
yeah, totally.
That's how we make it. It's not a real dish.
But... Oh my God, Alan, that's like such a, that's the most hilarious chef trick. Put a poached egg on it.
Put an egg on it.
It's the best. I do that all the time.
Yeah.
Anytime like I'm making like a leftovers meal at home and, you know, like I want it to be, I want to put in a little extra effort to make it like nice and fancy, yeah. But you know, maybe I'm not like super excited about what we're going to be eating. I just like,
yeah,
I'll put a poached egg on top. Yeah. And that usually just like makes it,
sets it off somehow.
Yeah. An amazing meal.
Yeah. I don't know if like, it always, it makes me think of the Portlandia sketch, like put a bird on it. Like it's just become like this kind of token thing that our generation does now. But yeah, like in this situation, like you still get the egg flavor and not the same texture exactly as traditional scrambled egg, but like you get the egg. So it's like, but it looks, it presents much better. So it's like beet fried rice with bacon and egg. That's actually how we make it.
Sounds delicious. After this pandemic, I'm coming over for dinner.
And I, like I said, I'm going to start a petition or a referendum or something and make that the provincial dish of Alberta.
I mean, it certainly fits in. Okay, well, I feel like from the name of your dish, I got a pretty good idea of what it should be.
Yeah, oh, I agree. Yep.
I was also... flip-flopping in my head about whether to use raw beets or not. If I was going to use raw beets though, I was going to say that I was going to grate them.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and still like even, yeah, there's lots of ways you could play with it. Like I haven't tried this, but I know that I think that Heston Blumenthal had like a beet risotto and I don't know if it included rice or if like the beets were like the rice or what, but it's the dish is like a, the entire dish is a very deep and vibrant purple, like the color of beets. Right. And so you could probably take this dish in that direction somehow. Like you don't want to be adding beet juice and liquid like that because it would make it stodgy. But I don't know, something like that. Like yeah, I'm sure there's other ways to do it. But
yeah. Heston Blumenthal, haven't thought about that guy in a while.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He's not relevant anymore? I think about him still.
I don't know. He probably is. I don't know. I'm like unplugged from the London cooking scene, I guess, but I think he has a recipe for potato risotto where the rice is potatoes.
Oh, okay.
So I wonder if also his beet risotto is like the rice is beets.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. I made that dish a few times. It's nightmare.
Potato risotto.
Yeah. Because you it's like, if you don't cut the potatoes, so that they're each, so that the pieces of potato are the size of a grain of rice, it's not really worth calling it risotto.
Yeah.
Because you're just making something else. So you have to cut the potatoes so that, you know, each little piece of potato is the size of a grain of rice.
Right.
And how I was doing that was like using a mandolin to make like really fine julienne. Mm-hmm. And then I was like cutting the julienne into, you know, like
rice size,
cutting
pieces.
The julienne into, yeah, rice size little pieces or whatever. And yeah, it took a long time to prep a pretty small amount.
was it just for home consumption?
No, I think it was at the Blue Pear.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was a side to a dish that we were doing at the Blue Pear.
At least a couple times in Edmonton, I saw dishes on menus in fancy restaurants that were just like 100% ripped from Heston Blumenthal.
Oh, yeah.
Like 10 years ago, but like...
Yeah, at the Blue Pear, we did a lot of like recipes that were like the dishes were creations like of Darcy's. He was the chef there.
Yeah, but some of the elements
were taken. Yeah, but a lot of the components were like, yeah, pulled from other sort of like, I wouldn't say that the Blue Pear was like strictly like a modernist sort of restaurant or anything like mm-hmm. that, but a lot of the dish components, like Darcy was really interested in like using new modern techniques and like trying out new things all the time.
Right.
And
yeah.
So we did a lot of like modernist techniques.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we would pull them from like Heston Blumenthal's books or like the Alinea cookbook.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or I don't know if we actually pulled anything from El Bulli, because we didn't actually have the El Bulli cookbooks, but in the kind of more in the like heyday of modernist cuisine, mm-hmm. that we pulled a lot of recipes from, mm-hmm. like there was a website called Chemos. I don't know if it still exists, probably does. But it had like basically a huge PDF of like tons and tons and tons of like modernist techniques on it. And okay. we would like pull techniques out of there and then use whatever ingredients we wanted or mm-hmm. yeah, it's fun. Okay, Alan. So, I think do you have another one to present to me?
I mean, I could, no.
No. Okay, cool. Fair enough. Okay. Well, are we ready? Are you ready to tackle my dish, Alan?
I'm excited.
Okay. Oh, man. We definitely only have time for one, and I have two really sweet ones.
This will be a recurring segment. Don't worry.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, which one? Okay. This was my favorite. But it sort of... Well, I guess we'll see how it goes. I feel like the name of the dish contains a lot of information. So
it's a lot to unpack. Okay. Just say it.
But there's also a lot of cues for how you might go about preparing it. But okay. I guess we'll find out. The reason why I think it was smart of you to present me with a dish that you've prepared before, because this dish that I'm about to present to you, I have never prepared okay. before. I have a recipe for it. I know how it's supposed to be prepared, but I've never actually made it. So it'll be a little more difficult for me to offer a critique on your method,
okay.
but we'll see how it goes. Okay, so the dish is called Turkey Taco Quinoa Skillet.
Turkey Taco Quinoa Skillet. Okay. That's all I got.
That's what you got.
Okay, I'm going to leave the turkey for a minute and just say taco skillet. And I'm going to guess what that means. So it's cooked in a skillet, but I think this is kind of like the broader sense of skillet, as in like a kind of a one pot meal that's like, yeah, it's put in front of you like, yeah, like paella and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Okay. So a taco skillet, I'm going to guess that we're working with ground turkey probably, or it could be strips of turkey, whatever. That's the meat component.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if rice is usually in tacos. I think of burritos when I think of rice, but I'm going to assume that quinoa is kind of like the stand-in for or maybe the quinoa is kind of like the bulk of this dish. Like this is like basically like a rice dish, only we're using quinoa instead. And then the taco element, we're probably working with like onions and tomatoes and lime juice. And there's probably, maybe you could add like a crispy, it's like a tortilla, whatever. From the name of the dish, I'm guessing we're crumbling Tostitos over it or something like that. I'm actually going to approach this a little bit, actually kind of like our fried rice conversation. So I have pre-cooked quinoa. I always cook my quinoa pasta method, by the way, not pilaf method. I find that works out way better.
Okay.
And so I have pre-cooked quinoa chilled. And then in my skillet, if it's ground turkey, I'm going to fry that up first and try and get a bit of color on it. For fat, honestly, this is a whole other conversation we have. Like, I usually cook, I most often cook with lard at home. So I would cook the turkey in lard, but whatever, olive oil or canola oil would be fine. Brown that ground meat, take it out. And then I'll add, for my aromatics, just like minced onion and garlic. And because this is a taco skillet, I'll add cumin and oregano and cayenne or some kind of chili flake. Saute that and then add in this kind of, for these flavors, I would probably add diced bell pepper, cooked to soft. Add the quinoa. Oh, sorry, some kind of tomato product, like whatever I have in the fridge, tomato sauce, tomato paste. Once everything's cooked out and aromatic, add the quinoa in. Once it's hot, back add the lightly browned ground turkey. And then I would just like go crazy with garnishes. I would be like drizzling sour cream and like putting a lime wedge on it and fresh diced tomatoes and crispy tortilla and avocado wedge and cilantro and just like make it all sexy that way. That's what I got. Turkey. That's my turkey taco skillet.
Okay, Alan. Turkey taco quinoa skillet.
Turkey taco quinoa skillet.
Okay. With one sort of major omission, you basically just described the recipe that I have in front of me right now. Okay. Well, one major ingredient omission.
Salt.
And then,
just kidding.
well, yeah, actually, Alan, this recipe does have salt in it. And then one sort of technical, one piece of the technique that, that's quite a bit different.
Okay.
So in this recipe, it's ground turkey. They have some diced chilies, also diced tomatoes, cumin, like you said, onions, garlic, as aromatics. A fairly large component of this dish is beans.
Which, okay. Yep.
Yeah. And then they actually cook the quinoa in the pan. So
okay.
They brown the turkey in the pan and then they add the aromatics on top of the turkey and then cook it until the aromatics are nicely sort of cooked.
Mm-hmm.
And then they add stock or water, and then they add the quinoa. And then they cook the quinoa pilaf style in the pan with the turkey and some of the other components.
Mm-hmm.
And then take the lid off and just go crazy with garnishes. But the one major omission is cheese. They put a ton of cheese on top of this thing and then put the lid back on to melt the cheese. I don't know if you've ever had a taco without cheese, Alan, but man, that's a sad taco.
I think we mentioned this when we were talking about cooking for kids, that my wife and daughter don't eat dairy. So when we make tacos, I put tacos or nachos or pizza or whatever, like I put cheese on mine, but not on theirs. But yeah, fair enough. For something called a turkey taco quinoa skillet to not have cheese on it. That's by which I mean just white trash version of Mexican food to not have orange cheese on it. Yeah, you're right. That was bad. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Gotta have cheese. And then tons of garnishes. In the recipe, they actually say that you can break up hard tortillas on top.
Right.
Or you can scoop it into hard taco shells, or you could scoop it into soft corn or flour tortillas.
Right.
So it gives all those options for serving, which
is versatile.
Yeah. I was pretty surprised actually at the thoughtfulness of all of the serving suggestions.
Yeah. I just called it white trash Mexican, but if that were seasoned well, how could that be bad? It sounds great.
No, it sounds delicious. And I didn't bring it up to make fun of it, but man, the name
is mouthful.
So insane. I don't know what it is about the the turkey taco quinoa skillet, but I was just like, oh my God, this is the dish.
Doesn't roll off the tongue.
No, like it's a mouthful.
Yeah.
I was actually surprised that, like, I understand why you said that you would pre-cook the quinoa. And like, that totally makes sense. But like, I was surprised when you said that, because when you first started thinking about it, you were like, oh yeah, like it's a skillet. So it's like a one pot dish.
Right.
And yeah, yeah. So like, and usually those one pot dishes, like all of the one pot dishes, like on the internet or like Instapot dishes, it's basically like you know, put in everything
right.
all yeah. at once into the one pot.
That's and true. Yeah.
So
the
cooking your quinoa ahead would be like an extra step that nobody has time for in this day and age, Alan.
Well, yeah. Like, and I think, to be honest, a dish like that, whether like, cause like, we don't make paella at home, but we do all kinds of like what we would just call like, like Mexi rice or something like that. Just like
yeah.
rice and some kind of meat and tomato and chili and like we do it both ways, either like pilaf style from raw rice or stir fry style with leftover rice. And it just depends what we have on hand. And the end result is a little bit yeah. different, obviously, but like when you're cooking at home, who cares? Like they're both delicious. And it's just like the expediency of, do I have leftover rice on hand or am I working with raw
yeah,
stuff?
Totally.
So yeah, if I like had to make that, if I had all the raw ingredients on hand right now, and needed to make that recipe, like, yeah, I wouldn't pre-cook the quinoa. I would, yeah. Pilaf style sounds just right. fine. Same. Yeah. Like,
but if you had that quinoa in the fridge, you'd be like, yeah, oh man, yeah. turkey taco quinoa skillet. Here we come.
Exactly.
They also have corn in here, which was,
oh, okay. Yeah.
I think a nice addition.
Yep. I like corn in my chili.
And I would be tempted to put so much cilantro on this that nobody else would want to eat it, but yeah. I would.
There's always these kind of watershed moments where you, like, you kind of know how to do something, but then you see someone do it a different way, and it just like opens up a door to 1,000 different ways of doing it. And the this is not like fancy fine dining kind of stuff, but like working at Daddio, which is a Cajun. Or like a whatever it's called, Daddio New Orleans Diner or Cajun Diner, I can't remember, in Edmonton here.
Yeah, it's like a Cajun Diner.
And seeing how they make jambalaya, and it was just like exactly like the rice that I cook at home, only instead of the water component, it's like part tomato sauce and part water and like their house Cajun spice, and then they're also sauteing sausage and ham and shrimp before they put the rice. I don't know, like because before then, like to me, rice was, yeah, my mom would cook white rice to serve with chicken or fish or whatever. But yeah, to see how much you can add to it and how simple it is. And yeah, it really opened my eyes. As a young cook, I was like, oh, that's, wow, there's a lot you could do with that. And this is kind of an asinine thing to say, but yeah, that was actually like a big deal to me when I saw it.
Yeah. I think I had one of those moments with frittata.
Yeah.
I don't exactly know why, but yeah, like at some point I learned how to make frittatas like pretty well. And then, yeah, just like realized that you can basically stuff them with whatever you want. And for a long time, that was like my go-to.
Yeah. And it's so like, it's actually embarrassing to say something like that, I think, as a chef, where you're like, yeah, obviously you can put whatever you want in rice or in frittata. But one of the, like, I just talk about it endlessly, like the power of seeing kind of generalized concepts in food preparation, like thinking of when you see something that seems very specific, like preserved lemons, like, oh yes, in Moroccan cuisine, this is how they preserve lemons and this is what it tastes like and how you can use it. But if you are able to generalize it and be like, well, that's actually a way of preserving citrus. Like any citrus, like you could preserve limes. Like you don't see yeah. that in Moroccan recipes, I don't think. But if you're able to, yeah, make it into a general concept, then you're, yeah, it really frees you up and you can do some fun stuff.
Yeah, totally. I've never preserved anything besides lemons. I can picture the limes though, and they're nasty looking.
I've never done it. I actually saw it. There's a company in Edmonton called Mojo Jojo Pickles, and they do preserve limes.
Oh, and are they green?
I think so. Like the preserved lemons are yellow, right?
Yeah, but yellow is like a super
stable pigment,
tough color to destroy, and green is like the easiest color to destroy.
But is the
limes just like destroy their own green while they're sitting there on the shelf? Like eventually they just turn brown.
Huh. Okay. Because for a while Mojo Jojo was operating out of the same kitchen I was working in, and I think they had beautiful green preserved limes, but I will look back at that.
Yeah, super curious to find out about that. I'd like to try that. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can do the same preservation method with oranges, because I mean preserved lemons are great, but yeah. I'd be super curious to try.
Yeah, I imagine that you can, and the process would be the same. You would probably use them differently because there's not as much acidity, but yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's sort of what I'm wondering too, because like, I mean, you're packing them in salt, so the salt is doing a lot of the preservation aspect of it, but there's also so much acidity in the lemon one that I wonder if like there's a point during, because they ferment, I wonder if there's a point during the fermentation when, because it must be a lacto fermentation, I would imagine. I don't actually know. Mm-hmm. But like there's probably a point during the fermentation where like the salt is protecting from bad pathogens. And then there's probably a point during the fermentation when the acidity is protecting from bad pathogens. And I wonder if there's like a point where that switches over, or if it doesn't even matter and the salt is doing all of the preservation or something like that. I'm super curious about it now.
Probably don't know enough about it to even say anything, but like, cause I had similar thoughts about like the similarities and differences between sauerkraut and kimchi.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Cause people always portray chili as like this great preservative. And so I was like, well, how can you make something like kimchi that obviously ferments, that's just like so packed full of capsaicin, like wouldn't it just kill all the microbes? But it doesn't. And they're both like kimchi and sauerkraut are both lacto fermentation. Mm-hmm. But I think that the slightly different salt contents and the slightly different temperatures and maybe the presence of the chilies, I don't know, like it does adjust exactly what cultures are able to thrive there, but they're all kind of doing the same thing. They're producing acid and gas and flavors like that. But,
yeah, well, and there's a lot of, like, there are a lot more additives in kimchi, right?
Yeah.
Which probably, you know, like, just inherently carry some of the funky flavors that you wind up with in kimchi.
Definitely the flavors, although that's another thing I, like, take exception to, is that so many of the online sources for kimchi recipes insist that the seafood components are what are bringing the like microbes that are doing the fermentation to the party, which is not true at all. Well, yeah, actually.
But we know that that's obviously not true.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it. Yeah. It's categorically not true. Like you don't, like it's not the like little shrimps or the fish sauce or anything like that. Like the fish sauce is pasteurized, I think. But it just like, that's not what's doing the ferment. It's in like natural, like indigenous microbes on the vegetables. Right? Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Or in the environment.
Yeah. 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 Like endemic. Yeah, exactly.
Like
endemic.
Not necessarily on the vegetables, but yeah.
But just in endemic like microbes that are present. And like you can make kimchi without using seafood products. I mean, I don't know if it gets like protected status or something, but like you can certainly ferment cabbage with all the other kimchi trappings like chili without adding those seafood products.
And haven't you made a kimchi that was that didn't have seafood in it, or am I wrong? Did you just
I have, but the like the ones that we did a kimchi tasting and the ones I think all the ones that I had brought there, they contained fish sauce in them.
Like because also I've had white kimchi. Mm. Not 100% sure, but I think the white kimchi that I had did not contain fish products.
Okay.
And it did contain chili, obviously. But yeah, it was like still very different from sauerkraut. So
it is, there's an entire, like there's a whole section on, sorry, in on food and cooking about the differences between sauerkraut and kimchi, how they seem on the surface, like, yeah, it's cabbage and salt, but the way the cabbage is sliced and the temperature that they're fermented at brings different microbes to the party. And so like the sauerkraut is, it ends up being higher acid, and there's more of the yeast that's able to do fermentation in that process. Like the warmer, like cellar temperature fermentation brings these kind of like floral aromatics. Yeah. Whereas the colder kimchi fermentation is lower acid, but also has those interesting like gas producing microbes that give it its kind of effervescence and stuff.
Right.
And now I've told you literally everything that I know.
Because that's kimchi. True too, right? Like kimchi is usually fairly effervescent and sauerkraut is usually not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we'll have to do a whole show about it sometime. I'm definitely going to read that chapter of McGee.
Yeah.
I haven't picked up my McGee in a while. Where is that book even? Oh.
Yeah, it breaks. There's like a table right, and he breaks it down like fermentation temperature and salt content. So like kimchi, traditional kimchi recipes have a much higher salt content than sauerkraut.
Okay, yeah.
Sauerkraut's like 2%, like a normal European lacto ferment, and kimchi is like above 3. Anyways.
We'll save it for the kimchi episode.
Exactly. Well, I don't know if we talked about this. Like you and I did a kimchi tasting with Michael Chan.
Yeah, of all kimchis that you made. I didn't really contribute much besides the tasting.
I brought
part
a couple
of it,
like ones that I bought and ones that I had made.
Oh, right. That's true.
But I would love to. That's fine if you and I get around to eat, like, sorry, hook up and eat kimchi. But like, there's people in Edmonton who know a lot about kimchi, like a lot, certainly a lot more than I do.
Yeah.
And I want to like invite them and have a little kimchi festival like they do in Korea. I mean, not exactly like they do in Korea, but because there's people making like legit traditional kimchi in their basements that know a lot more about it. And I would love to taste theirs and have them taste mine.
Yeah, sounds amazing.
Someday.
As soon as we're out of this pandemic, Alan, kimchi it's festival.
We'll do it virtually. It's fine.
Oh, man. It sounds like a logistical nightmare. I don't know. I'm like really sensitive to, I don't know why, maybe I just really like spending time alone in my house or something, but anytime anyone suggests like trying to do something that you would normally do in real life, but doing it like virtually and like bringing, you know, like food to a bunch of different people in like, you know, a way that's safe so that you can all like share a meal over Zoom or something like that. I'm always just like, oh
terrible,
my God, I just want to tear my eyeballs out.
Yeah.
But maybe I should be more open to it.
Like the hardest, it wouldn't be hard to mail your kimchi to all the people who are part of the festival, but like Canada Post would probably go on strike, or like they would just put down their letter bags and right. Cause it would smell like kimchi.
Cause it would smell like kimchi. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I'd be like, what is in here?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you can completely seal it in like two layers of like thick, like freezer bags, and you can still smell it.
Yeah.
You gave me like 2 750 ml containers of kimchi that you made. Mm. And which I only have like 250 ml left of now or something. Yeah. Although that was a long time ago that you gave it to me. I've been slowly working my way through it. But it was in like those glass flip top jars.
Yeah, the old mustard
jars. Yeah, when I emptied one, I like cleaned it out by hand with soap and water, and then I put it through the dishwasher. And the next day I came downstairs and opened the dishwasher, and the whole dishwasher smelled like kimchi.
Yeah.
And I took the glass jar out, and the glass jar was just like stained with the smell of kimchi. Like,
yep.
I probably could have washed it like 12 times and it still would have smelled like kimchi.
Yeah. I have fermentation pails and glass jars that are just like, they're just earmarked for kimchi, and that's all they can do now. Cause if you put something else in them, they'll smell like garlic and funk. There was a, are we trying to wrap it up?
Nope.
There was a kind of notorious incident where we were at Elm Catering. We were cutting and wrapping the delicious salted caramels for Red Balloon, which was, I don't know if it still exists, was like a candy and pie company in Edmonton. And we would cut and wrap all of these amazing salty caramels and put them in bus tubs to be delivered to events and retailers and stuff like that. But we had a deep bus tub that had stored sliced onions in it in the last week or so. And even though it had gone through the dishwasher and stuff, like it still reeked of onions, and whoever loaded the caramels into the bin didn't notice. And so all these caramels were shipped to a private catering event, and all of the beautiful salted caramels, like in the French style, smelled and tasted of raw onion. And it ruined a lot of people's days.
What a nightmare.
Yeah.
So did they make it to the tables or yep. like to the...
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
Oh my God. I'm sorry to hear that, Alan.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm thinking about a recipe for onion caramels.
Caramelized onion caramel.
That's definitely probably a thing. Gross. I made caramelized onion ice cream before.
Oh yeah? Was it good?
It wasn't as good as I was hoping it would be.
Yeah. Was there...
It was one of those ideas where I was like, whoa, caramelized onions, those are like crazy and have like amazing sweet and savory flavors. What if we made an ice cream out of that?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was okay, but I made it like more than a decade ago and I haven't made it since. So.
Right. Well, I was thinking about green onion cakes recently, and I was thinking about making green onion cakes, only instead of using green onions, using caramelized onions. That could be good, right?
Yeah, that could be good.
Like
I think that having the green onions in the green onion cakes really does add something. I think like
it would be a different beast.
You could put caramelized onions in there, but you might still need to put green onions in also.
I think so.
Maybe. when we were working at the Blue Pear, my friend Clayton and I were like appalled at like how prevalent green onion cakes were in the Edmonton like festival food scene.
Right.
And, you know, we were always talking about our like raging jealousy for the people who are making like so much money off of selling such a simple dish. And we were going to take over the market with red onion cakes.
This is going to be so weird to anyone who's not from Edmonton, but like, I hate that people get upset about green onion cakes, that someone like,
oh, people do get upset about it.
Oh yeah. Like, cause people, there's always this really pathetic conversation about, oh, well, what's Canadian food and what's our food and all this stuff. And then someone will always like raise up green onion cakes, and then they just get shouted down.
As like an example of Edmonton food.
Yes. Yeah. Which I know like, yeah. Obviously it's made all over. Like, I don't know the exact origins of the version that we most often see in Edmonton, but like certainly like in Sichuanese cuisine, like they make green onion cakes and stuff like that. But
yeah. 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 The Sichuanese ones that I've had are like the most similar.
Yeah. Like really crispy, right?
Yeah. And like not very leavened.
Yeah. 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 But I don't know, like, so the, like the green onion cake man in Edmonton, I don't know if he's from Sichuan province, or I don't know anything about him. but it always, like, people always bring it up and then it always gets shouted down by really, well, sorry, by really pretentious food people. And sure, like, if something is served on a mass scale at festivals that have deep fryers, like, it's probably not of the highest quality, but like, if you go to the Green Onion Cake Man on Alberta Avenue, like, it's awesome. It's so, his green onion cakes are so good. Oh yeah, they're amazing. Yeah. Like, so anyways.
Also, you can buy them in freezer packs.
Is that right? Yeah.
I don't know if you knew that.
No, I didn't.
Yeah. I've gone there a few times and brought home like 3 packs and kept them in the freezer. And then they're like a real easy thing to like pull out and make for dinner.
Are they raw or cooked when they're frozen?
They're raw.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and they're separated by patty papers, and then you just pull them out. Like, you can't cook them from frozen. Like, you need to let them thaw before you actually cook them.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're amazing. Talking about green onion cakes is kind of making me feel guilty, though, because for the past like 4 or 5 weeks, I've been planning a staff lunch program at Kind Ice Cream. Mm. So we just moved to a new big kitchen facility and we have much more storage space and a lot more space to like do, you know, other types of cooking tasks and stuff. And so I thought it would be fun for everybody to have a week where they make staff lunch.
Mm-hmm.
Like on one day when most of the staff is there, each week somebody volunteers to make lunch for everybody just on one day.
Yep.
It's not like working in a normal restaurant kitchen where there's like always tons of savory food around. We'd have to bring in special food for it and stuff, so we can't really do it every day. But so anyways, I've been planning it for you know, like a little over a month, and then I communicated to the staff about it and told people to start thinking about ideas. And then tomorrow is supposed to be the first day and I was going to make green onion cakes, and it just turned out that because of the way the last few days went, there's just like, I was supposed to do the grocery shopping for it today, mm-hmm. and then prepare it tomorrow. But it just turned out that because of the way the last few days went, there just was not enough time for me to do the grocery shopping today or like looking at tomorrow even to prepare the lunch tomorrow. So I had to postpone it to next week. And so I feel horrible, but next week they'll be delicious.
So you've got a recipe?
Yeah. I definitely have a recipe somewhere. I've made them quite a few times. The recipe that I have might be like in my vast store of recipes that I rarely look at. But I made them a few times at Elm. I don't know if you were there when I did, but
no, I don't remember it. No.
Oh. Yeah, I made them a few times for staff lunch at Elm. Mostly when we were in the kitchen on 118th Ave. Mm-hmm.
You mean the kitchen that is now the Green Onion Cake Man? Did you ever?
Isn't
that wild?
Oh my God. Holy shit. I never even put that together.
Yeah, that's full circle.
Yeah, exactly. That kitchen where now all they make is green onion cakes. Yeah. Well, that's not entirely true, but
they also make Montreal style bagels.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sedeby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in your favorite podcast app. Check us out on the web at foodcourt.fm and follow us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to help spread the word, please leave us a review on iTunes. We'll be back with a fresh new episode in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.